You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Mr. Jones's Neighborhood. Good morning, neighbor. I'm glad we're together again. We have a very special show for you today on Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, the children's program for reluctant adults. I'm the host of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. We're now in pandemic month 5 or 6, I lost track, and friends are telling me there's a bright side to all this isolation and sheltering in place. They say things have been pretty quiet in the neighborhood, with the possible exception of unidentified federal stormtroopers shooting tear gas canisters, rubber bullets, and flashbangs at unarmed moms every night. Still, relatively quiet. I mean, compared to the busy schedules we all kept pre-pandemic, no commuting, no in-person appointments, no dining out, no movies, sporting events, live music, bridge tournaments.
Gee, Mom, isn't that bridge built yet?
Which means, they tell me, you should have plenty of free time to get to those writing and recording projects you've been putting off. You must be very productive, they tell me. Well, to be honest, that has not been the case here in Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, where we've been doing nothing other than watching old episodes of the classic TV Western Have Gun, Will Travel for the past few months. The episodes are over 60 years old, but hold up well thanks to great writing, acting, and directing, and the majestic presence of series star Richard Boone, so I don't regard it as a total waste of time. But I do know people who have been productive during this strange time, doing things, making things like books, music, podcasts, paintings, and washable face masks, mostly washable face masks. But even making face masks is a productive activity, not to mention beneficial, to the health and welfare of all of us in the neighborhood. And we know of one person, at least, who's been extremely productive, the legendary audio theater producer, director, and writer, Dirk Maggs. We had the privilege of talking with Dirk last year on the now-defunct Holy Crowley Hour, a monthly KBOO late-night radio show sponsored by an allegedly satanic cult led by Carl Crowley, Aleister Crowley's little-known brother. We welcomed a variety of guests in the 6-year run of the Holy Crowley Hour, luminaries from the world of radio theater, storytelling, podcast, comedy, not to mention a hypnotherapist, a yoga teacher, a cannabis advocate, several sex educators, and for one memorable Christmas show, the U-Log himself. Dirk Maggs was our guest on the September 2019 show, coming to us from his home in London, England, or New London, Connecticut. In any case, it was a long drive. We talked about Dirk's previous work in audio theater, including his BBC adaptations of the Superman, Batman, Spider-Man, and Judge Dredd comic books, directing and producing radio adaptations of the Alien movies and the X-Files TV show, and his current project at the time, the audio adaptation of Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett's novel, Good Omens. And, had to mention what is perhaps Dirk's best-known work, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, adapted for BBC Radio by Dirk at the request of the author, Douglas Adams. Since it's summer here in the neighborhood, which is traditionally the time for summer reruns, I decided to replay our conversation with Dirk from last September. But there's also another reason. Dirk's been busy writing, directing, and producing an audiobook based on Neil Gaiman's Sandman series of graphic novels. This was a pet project of Dirk's going back 28 years, and it was just released all 10 hours and 54 minutes on Audible. The description audiobook doesn't really do justice to the scope and scale of the Sandman production. Dirk likes to call them audio movies and will tell you that, quote, audio is the true visual medium. And he went all out for this one, using his mastery of telling a story entirely through sound, the art and craft acquired in a radio career spanning 4 decades. It's a relatively big budget production that not only does justice to the source material, but is a giant leap forward for audio drama. Here's just a partial list of the voice actors. James McAvoy in the title role, K. Kat Dennings, Samantha Morton, Taron Egerton, Bebe Neuwirth, Andy Serkis, Michael Sheen, and Sandman creator Neil Gaiman as the narrator. Hope you get a chance to listen to The Sandman, and also hope you enjoy this conversation with Dirk Maggs from last summer. It's truly a masterclass in audio theater. Dirk recently posted on Facebook how his pitch for an audio Sandman was turned down about 10 years ago by the then commissioning editor for drama at BBC Radio 4. While showing Dirk the door, the commissioning editor couldn't resist rubbing a little salt in the wound with these parting words, "Don't forget, Dirk, lots of young producers are in your rearview mirror, about to overtake you." While I hope this is true at some point, because we all stand on the shoulders of giants, it's been 10 years now, and no one's gotten close. Dirk, you've had a heck of a head start. Dirk Maggs, welcome to the neighborhood.
Thank you, Ken. It's a privilege to be here.
Now, Dirk, I've listened and read several of your previous interviews, and they usually start off asking how you got interested in radio theater. I'm going to ask the very same question because I know the answer. And it involves a highly influential show, both to listeners in the UK and to many Americans who do audio theater and comedy, The Goon Show. When did you start listening and what caught your ear?
Actually, it's funny because I was born in the 50s and The Goon Show was running then. It finished in 1961. And it featured Spike Milligan, who was this sort of resident comedy genius and very, very sensitive person. A lot of people thought Spike was he was bipolar in the sort of way where he was either very, very up or very, very down. And he created this show with Peter Sellers, who later became Inspector Clouseau in the Pink Panther films, and Harry Secombe, who was an English comedian. And this show just pulled no punches at all. And just revolutionized comedy in England. The Python Troupe got their ideas from it. So many writers were inspired by it. But the strange thing is, actually, I never heard it when it was going out. When I was about 8 years old, they did a sort of TV version with puppets called the Telegoons.
I've never heard of that.
If you YouTube it, it's there. It's kind of interesting. They redid some of the scripts without a studio audience. So there's a strange kind of dead quality to it. And that's what got me into it, because the puppets, you know, were very good. They kind of were about as crazy as the show was. And then I went in search of the original radio comedy shows, and it just fired me up because it was just so surreal and so wonderful, and just stupid lines like... I don't know, when you get the villains have no money, so they're always kind of, you know, in threadbare clothes. And there's one line where Gritpipe Thin, who's the sort of head villain, says to Moriarty, his deputy, "Please be still, Moriarty, or you'll have us both out of this suit." And it was just
what an image that puts in the listener's head.
And it's full of old musical, British musical comedy, really quite rude stuff, you know, kind of cheeky and naughty and end of the pier humor, which the British are good at. But it would hide some of the most really quite dirty army jokes, because these guys were all in the army, inside what seemed perfectly innocuous gags. So there's a lot of layers to The Goon Show. And it was visual. It just had this visual kind of sense. It had this big 22-piece orchestra, which was playing these big dramatic cues. And Spike would write scripts set in the last emperor of Tibet, you know, living in a mountain in Everest or something, or they'd set out climbing a mountain from the inside. It's just
stuff you could only do on the radio.
You can only do on the radio. And I mean, a lot of it's dated, but at its very, very best, The Goon Show is still very funny. In fact, I still, you know, he wrote 10 years worth, and he wrote 26 half-hour shows in a season for 10 years. I mean, no wonder the guy ended up in a mental hospital more than once. I just got one the other day, and one of the lines was... somebody said, "What are you doing up that tree?" And Bladnock says, I'm mountaineering on a very tight budget." That just gets me totally, and yet the image comes, you know. And I had the great privilege and pleasure of working with Spike.
Oh, I was going to mention that. That was on one of your early BBC projects. It was a version of the Marx Brothers radio show from the 30s, Flywheel, Shyster, and Flywheel. What was Spike like? You mentioned that he was bipolar and wasn't always, you know, as funny as he was on the radio on the Goon Show.
Yeah, he could. I mean, you could get on the wrong side of Spike, and then you were really in trouble because that was it. I was very lucky. We got on really, really well. I genuinely loved the man, and I'd met him a couple of times in my BBC career before I became a comedy producer. I'd worked in departments where he'd come in and do stuff, and occasionally I would ask him to do a little piece, you know, a little commercial for a radio program or something. So I sort of had met him, but I really got to know him when I did a documentary about the Goon Show, the one and only documentary I've ever made, because I found it extremely hard work. But Spike was, we got on terribly well. And in fact, I'm looking at, I have a framed letter from him on my wall thanking me for helping organize the repeats of some Goon Shows in the late 80s. And that's sort of a treasured possession, really, because a note from Spike saying yours warmly is a rare thing. So I feel I've sort of, you know, cracked it. And actually, I also have a bottle of wine he gave me in 1999 to drink in the millennium. But I've never drunk it because it was from Spike. So,
it's still unopened.
Silly sentimental.
Wow.
Yeah, still unopened. Still here. I can make, hang on, I'll give you a sound effect.
Okay.
That's the bottle. Yeah. You can, somebody with a real sharp ear can tell the age of the wine in there. It's probably vinegar by now, but never mind. Anyway, I'm rambling. I apologize.
Oh no! What? It's not rambling. It's actually exactly why I wanted you on the show. And these are great. I mentioned that there were other radio theater practitioners, some really good ones, who were also inspired by the Goon Show, Monty Python. And do you know the Firesign Theater also?
Oh, absolutely. Phil Proctor and the guys, absolutely geniuses to a man and woman. They're wonderful.
Were you also influenced by them in addition to the Goon Show, both Firesigns and Monty Python?
I hadn't heard Firesigns so much at the time. Python, obviously, you know, that was happening when I was in my teens. And for me, Python was like the Goon Show. You know, when we were at school the next day, we were all swapping the, you know, we were all kind of performing the previous night's script to each other and so on. Firesign I only discovered much later on, really, when I'd got into radio. So there was less of that kind of emotional thing when you're young and you discover what you think is your comedy that only you know about, that thing when you're a teenager and, you know, you're the band that you like, no one else knows about, or the comedy you like, no one else knows about. Although, to be fair, in Python's case, as I say, we were all quoting it the next day, Spanish Inquisition or Dead Parrot or whatever. But it was, you know, it's a fantastic thing for someone, for a radio comedy show. And, you know, let's face it, Firesign are much respected and loved in America, but, you know, radio comedy as a thing per se, you know, has not been, you know, a thing in the States for many years. And for a British comedy show to have that sort of influence down the years and to still be influencing people, I mean, I still, you know, kind of mentally quote Spike when I'm making stuff now, because a lot of it is the timing. In fact, one of the things when I first applied to become a comedy producer, one of the announcers I was working with, one of the you know, the voices on the BBC, took me to, he said, oh, I know who you should meet Dennis Mayne Wilson. He's the guy who brought the Goon Show to radio. And I met this producer called Dennis Mayne Wilson, who was very well respected. He not only discovered the Goons, he discovered a guy called Tony Hancock, who had a very seminal kind of situation comedy show on BBC Radio in the 50s. And he also created or helped create a program which over here was called Till Doth Us Depart. But over in the States on TV, Norman Lear turned into All in the Family, the Archie Bunker.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, well, Dennis, you know, had this kind of lineage, and he could drink for England and he could talk for England. And so I spent about 3 hours in a pub one lunchtime with him telling me all his stories, which was fascinating. But what was also interesting was him talking to me about how important it was to have timing, a sense of timing, where to drop the bomb, where to, you know, where to tell the gag, where to put the tagline, the punchline, all of these sort of things that, you know, came from comedy have actually influenced my work since. So if I'm doing anything dramatic, even if it's really, really serious, when I'm writing the script or working with the actors, generally speaking, you feel there's a rhythm to things and you kind of know where to, you know, where to drop the bomb, as they say, which is a kind of a drumming expression, actually, because I'm a drummer.
I was going to ask you about that, about the sense of rhythm that you bring to audio drama as a musician. You were then and you still are a drummer.
Mm, absolutely. And there was a thing about, you know, drumming. And of course, Dennis would be talking about the days of, you know, big bands and jazz and so on. And but there is this sort of thing where jazz drummers, you know, it's a very subtle art that they, you know, they kind of play along. They're weaving in and out. But just occasionally, you've got, you know, put a boof in there. And that just kicks the thing into a new direction or whatever. And it kind of is... it's analogous to the process of either writing or directing audio. There is a certain natural rhythm to things.
Oh, I think that's definitely true about audio drama, audio comedy. And in fact, there's times when I will listen to lines, not even paying attention to the content of the dialogue, but just the rhythm of the dialogue. Mm. And of course, as you know, there's pauses that you put in between pieces of dialogue, between scenes. It's all rhythm. You've got to get those pauses absolutely correct.
It is. In fact, one of the things I spend a lot of time impressing on actors is please, please observe the punctuation. Because if I've done an adaptation or a script, if I've written anything, I'm really, really careful about how I use punctuation. And it to me, a comma or a colon or a semicolon all have different beats attached to them. It is like a dotted note or a breath or a rest in musical terms, you know. And also the way the line is delivered. Some are delivered at speed, like eighth notes, and some are in, you know, more regular speed, like quarter notes. You know, it's a kind of a... it becomes a musical analogy. I don't want to stretch this metaphor to snapping point, but there is a lot of that in it.
Oh, no, I definitely hear it in a well-produced a piece. Now, you started as a producer or early in your career at the BBC I get a laugh out of this, the light entertainment department, which I guess is a Britishism for comedy.
Yeah.
And,
yes.
And your
there
first
was a company in London, you know, the independent radio company for years called Heavy Entertainment, which I thought was really
the opposite. Good, yes, the opposite of light.
Way, opposite. And, yeah, light entertainment. That was the BBC's rather starchy 1940s way of describing the comedy department. But to be fair, it also covered the fact that they would do drama, a kind of a light drama. In fact, you know, that was sort of my loophole, how I got into doing what I did, because although I came aboard at Radio Light Entertainment as a comedy producer, actually, I was then able to make my original audition pieces, which was to suggest program ideas, was to suggest that we did a celebration of Superman's 50th birthday. And part of that idea was that we could dramatize bits from classic Superman stories. And I couldn't have done that in a strictly comedy department, because light entertainment meant, you know, anything north of Ibsen is okay. we could do that. So actually, light entertainment, yeah, it does sound kind of stuffy and archaic, but actually it was a fascinating experience, because of course all my heroes had passed through there, you know, all the guys, you know, who produced the Goon shows, the Charles Chiltons and the Peter Browell and so on, you know, John Browell, pardon me, all the guys, Dennis Main Wilson, had come through Light Entertainment. And of course, Douglas Adams, 10 years before I joined the department, had been there briefly as a producer, but mostly as the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which obviously became a part of my life later on. And so I was, you know, my dad had always loved radio comedy. So I was going into this place which had all this sort of history for me. The thing that surprised me most about it was the least fun place I'd worked with. All the babies. I didn't realize people took comedy so seriously.
That's what I've heard about a lot of comedians. But that first production you did, Dirk, Superman on Trial, was somewhat of a comedy. It was, I mean, the premise was Superman was on trial with Lex Luthor as the prosecutor, Lois Lane as his defense attorney. As you mentioned, it started as a tribute to Superman, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the first appearance in comic books. What was the origin? You wrote that, you directed it, you produced it?
Yeah, basically I had to, I'd been making trailers, you know, promos for the one of the music networks on BBC, and that was definitely a means to an end to get myself into radio. Light entertainment to the comedy department. That's where I knew I wanted to go. And so we, one of these trailers we did was for a sort of a neighborhood watch scheme, you know, like everybody keeps an eye on everyone's houses in case there's, you know, people breaking in and so on and so forth. And there was this sort of public service message aspect to it. And we were trying to think of an angle whereby we could promote this. And we thought, oh, great detectives, you know, Sherlock Holmes and Miss Marple and all of this. And I said, we could do Batman. And that was, you know, like, wow, yeah, we could do Batman. And then, well, if I've, you know, being BBC, you have to ask permission. So I'd have to ring DC Comics in New York. And this was the late 80s. And ringing New York was like, you know, calling Mars. And ringing DC Comics was like calling John Johns on Mars. It was an impossible thing. It couldn't be true. Actually, DC said, well, why don't you make it? Because we've got somebody swinging by through London on their way to the Frankfurt Book Fair, so they can come and check and see if it's okay. And this very nice lady called Chantal Dornis came in, who is actually Dutch, but she was working in New York for DC at that time, and she came through and she heard our silly Batman trail, which was very much sub Adam West kind of effort with me playing Robin, I think. Anyway, you know, it's a long story, but we used to do an awful lot of really weird stuff in this promo department. And she said, yeah, that's fine. Why don't you do it? And as she left, you know, she said, oh, by the way, it's Superman's 50th birthday next year. You might want to do something with that. And it was just the time when I was putting in my submission, my application to become a producer. And they wanted three program ideas. So I thought, right, you know, 50th birthday. But the idea of actually putting Superman on trial came later. At the time, I just thought it would be a documentary. But then I thought, no, it'd be much more fun to actually, you know, make something actually live in sound terms, turn in, you know, do a Superman movie of some kind, just, you know. It was a period of time when a lot of the old Hollywood film stars were dying. And if you listen to the radio news in the morning, they used to play a clip from one of the movies and you'd hear all the incidental sound effects along with the dialogue, all the Foley and people moving about and lighting cigarettes and all the stuff they would do. And you kind of, you know, and listening to this stuff, I could see the scene in my head, even if I wasn't familiar with the movie. The Foley and the sound effects gave you a visual clue as to what was going on. And I thought, I'd love to try doing that in a dramatic sense in sound only sometime. And this was my opportunity. So Superman on Trial, you know, Chantal's visit and chance suggestion kind of moved things forward very much for me, because it gave me the idea of actually creating pictures in sound, in pure sound. And Superman on Trial was the very first time we did that. And in fact, I wasn't even allowed to direct it. I was allowed to write it, but I wasn't even supposed to be in the studio while they recorded it, but I wasn't going to miss it. But afterwards, Neil Cargill, who directed it, who was a lovely guy, I said, look, do you mind if I take this away and, you know, edit it and mix the sound effects in and so on? And we'd done quite a few sound effects actually in the room. And he said, sure. And so I went away and I basically pulled several all-nighters in one of the studios in Broadcasting House, because in those days you could do that kind of thing. You know, trying to make it as visual as I could, adding all these noises. And it was really an interesting experience. And it was very exciting because I kind of, it was funny, about 2 a.m. one night, I was trying to add, you know, some kind of subtle feel of people moving or Superman's cape swishing or something. But it was a fine point. And I'm doing this on quarter-inch tape machines. This is before we're using digits at the BBC.
Oh, right. So you're cutting, you're splicing and pasting together.
Yeah, and spooling stuff in off two tape machines at a time. And I'm on my own in the room. You know, it's 2 a.m. And I had this thought. I had this sudden thought. I thought, holy smoke, yeah, this really works. I thought, I had two thoughts. I thought, wow, this really works. And I thought, oh God, this is really going to be a time-consuming way to make a living, because you know, to achieve that effect.
Yes, audio editing.
Actually doing that kind of thing is such a huge deal. You know, in terms of the concentration levels for audio, I think are higher than anything, because you kind of tend to work on your own. So it was a kind of mixed blessing. I thought, I think I've hit on something here. And I also thought, oh, crikey, I'm really, yeah.
Were
I
you
can
getting,
see myself ending up where Spike was, you know, in a home.
Oh, a bipolar, right? Were you using sound effects, Dirk, from the BBC library, which I guess was the biggest in the world? Maybe it still is.
To be honest with you, I was stealing them from film soundtracks.
Ah.
That's an admission. Because the BBC sound effects were just too parochial. They were too... You know, film soundtracks, late 80s, had already discovered digital sound. And, you have people like Ben Burtt, Lon Bender, and all these guys, you know, doing this amazing, sound design with really meaty bottom end and big crunchy top end. And frankly, BBC sound effects just, you know, no way could they compete. Gary Rydstrom, you know, doing all that stuff for Spielberg and all the guys at Skywalker Ranch. So, yeah, I basically stole stuff. If I needed something that was really big and beefy, I stole it and I mixed it up with a bunch of other stuff. And since then, I've realized that an awful lot of stuff in the movies, they were all doing the same with each other. You know,
yes, it's the club.
But I needed that big beefy sound. And I also wanted it fully scored. So I would go to library music, you know, which is not commercially available, but you get orchestral music cues, which people use for dramas on TV or commercials. And you can pay to use that for audio as well. So, you know, kind of really trying to give the whole thing all the production values of a movie just without a camera in the room.
You're listening to Mr. Jones's Neighborhood on KABU Community Radio. On today's show, we're replaying our September 2019 interview with Dirk Maggs, legendary audio theater producer, director, and writer. Dirk's audio adaptation of Neil Gaiman's The Sandman has just been released on Audible. Now, you actually did Batman a few years later. What really fascinated me, you said in an interview that you wanted to differentiate the sounds of Superman's city, Metropolis, from Batman's Gotham City. I guess the creators originally both based those on New York. What did you find the differences between the two cities, and how did you express that through sound alone?
It's silly little things. Like Metropolis, you could hear birds singing, and Gotham City, you couldn't. Kind of really simple, but... You know, it's kind of interesting how one sound effect can change one's perception of a setting. And you can have the same kind of city skyline atmosphere, which is, you know, kind of like recorded from the top of a tall building. A city, you cannot pick out individual traffic. You just kind of hear this general ambient kind of quiet roar. And then if that is your city setting, then if you add a little bit of wind and breeze and bird song to it, it becomes a sunny, pleasant city with trees in it. If you don't have that, or you add a cold sounding wind over it, you get this rather bleaker, grayer, washed out sort of thing, which could be Gotham City. And it's kind of that simple, but you know, if you choose the right ingredients, if you if you leave the currants out of the mixture, then you're not making a scone, you're just making a biscuit. I don't know how to put this, you know, but...
No, instead of a generic city, you've actually given them personalities here. You know, Metropolis and Gotham City. One's kind of a little lighter than the Superman city, and then Batman's darker. You see that in the movies.
Yes,
Batman's
you do.
Become very dark in a lot of the recent movies.
It does. And if you, you know, if any in any given scene in Gotham City, you hear distant sirens, you know, the place, the police are never not racing to a crime scene in Gotham, whereas Metropolis, you know, you're more likely to be sitting outside having a latte on the sidewalk outside the front of a cafe and Superman flies past, you know, kind of salutes you. You know, it's that kind of. It sounds kind of Mickey Mouse and simplistic, but sometimes the simplest way to paint a picture, the primary colors can work really, really well. And that was kind of the trick. It was a joy to do it. It was a joy to the very first thing we did in Batman, where he's confronting a thief on a roof and he hangs him off the corner of a gargoyle or something. you know, it, just painting the backdrop to that, you know, that was kind of like, how does Gotham City sound? And that's the best fun ever, because, you know, you have to think about the realities of what the sound of a place would be. It stops being a sort of drawing in a comic book, and it becomes three dimensional. And if you get it right, you can kind of smell it. I don't mean that in a kind of bad way, but well, it could be a bad way. But you do get that sort of, I love the sense of real life going on while our characters are doing stuff in the foreground. That was always a thing I liked. And that's the thing about movies. In movies, you have to see it. You have to, it has to be presented to you on the screen for you to understand it. And it, in what we do, you have to be cleverer with it. You have to somehow get that stuff through the message, either through the dialogue or the sound effects or a mixture of both. And it can be quite quite an art. But in the end, sometimes the obvious way of doing things is really the best way.
Now, you call your, to put this in context, you call your radio productions actually audio movies and say that, quote, audio is the true visual medium, which sounds at first a little like a Zen Cohen, since there are media that are expressly visual, such as movies and TV. So what do you mean by the true visual medium?
Well, for a start, I do it as much as anything to raise a flag over our modest little anthill amongst the mountains of the movie business. you know, so hyperbole, you know, is part of one's arsenal of tricks to draw attention. But that said, actually, I really do believe that if something is made right and you listen to it in the right mood, the pictures do come unbidden to your mind. And this is becoming a sort of cliche for me to say, but basically the visual information bypasses the optic nerve. It goes in through the side doors, your ears, and then you have a widescreen image in your brain. And I wouldn't say it if I didn't think it was true. For some people, it isn't true. There are people who really cannot process sound information in a visual way, but most people can. And the example when I'm talking to students about this, working in sound, pure sound, is that if you're ever after a very good lunch at home and, you know, or wherever you live, and whoever you share the place with is in another room, drops a book or a spoon, and you happen to be drifting off to sleep, your dream incorporates that sounding, or that sound becomes explained. If you happen to be dreaming, it becomes explained in the context of a dream. And I this is something that has happened to me, and it seems a lot of other people seem to say that it's happened to them as well. And something about the way the ear and the brain processes information, it sort of absorbs and contextualizes it. And so I did once about 20 years ago, possibly, did some Agatha Christie's. And there was one where it was set in the First World War, and it was a nun in a church, which was going to be invaded by German troops. And I And the producer said he really wanted us to use Mozart's Requiem as the music, so edit Mozart, no pressure there. But the thing was that this we went the script opened straight in this church with this nun and the Germans marching in. I thought, no, hang on a minute. I want to set the scene. I want to set the scene. So I kind of I started I did this whole sort of soundscape, starting in the trenches on the front lines, with shells whistling over and machine guns going, and some guy over on the left blowing a harmonica or something, all the cliches, and then like a sort of boom camera, moving back to the supply lines, then back to where the horses were kept in the quartermaster stores, and then back to the village where there was some traffic, and then into the church where she was saying her prayers. And this was kind of like a, oh, I know, about a 70 or 80 minutes worth, 70 or 80 seconds worth of sound effects that led you to the point where you found her in the church. And that was a moment when I thought, I played it to people and they got what it was meant to be. And at that point, I thought, this is actually something that I can use. This does work. And so over the years, I've discovered that actually you can create a lot of images without the need for words. And I said, one of my big ongoing discussions with Neil Gaiman, who I work with a lot, is, do we need a narrator? Because Neil likes there to be a narrator and I don't. Neil likes there to be the sort of solid bedrock of someone telling you what's going on. And I like to chance the idea that if you just do it in sound effects, it'll still tell the story.
Narration is almost somewhat lazy in a lot of audio pieces. It's kind of like exposition in the movies. It's they weren't able to show, so they tell.
I agree. Although I should swiftly add that Neil is anything but lazy. He just wants to get the maximum amount of
I
information
hope that didn't
across.
come
And
off as me calling
no,
him.
well, no, it's between you and him now, Ken, I'm afraid
Oh
he's
yeah.
a vengeful guy.
That's what I've heard. I did have a quote
Nah.
from you, Dirk. You said previously, all of my work, I have a visual image in my mind. So you start with a visual image. I'll have a sort of movie screen in front of me. And if you listen on earbuds or whatever, you hear the characters move around within a sort of cinema frame. And I was wondering how you achieve that. In one previous interview, you mentioned the positioning of the microphone and the actors positioning the actors in relation to the microphone.
Yeah, there are two ways to go about it. You can, if you work with a stereo microphone, which let's talk stereo to start with, because we can go into all sorts of layers here. But basically, working in stereo, if you have a stereo microphone in a large enough space, you can move the actors around it in such a way as to create actual physical movement in the recording. And then if you listen on a pair of stereo headphones, the headphones will give you the information that the microphone picked up. And in a sense, you're getting a sort of three-dimensional image, even though it's only in stereo, it's not even in binaural. It's literally just a stereo cross pair of mics or a cross capsule. And if somebody moves to the left, then they go to the left. And if somebody walks behind them, then you hear the voice become slightly attenuated by that physical movement. So it's a very, very dynamic way to record things. The only problem is that it can also be time-consuming because you have to block the actors. That would be the same for binaural. Blocking means, you have to tell, please move over there. And then when you say this line, move over here. Or actually, would you say that line while you're moving? Otherwise, if you move and you're not saying anything, then suddenly you'll jump from left to right. All these things that become rules that we have to observe in this business. This it can be time consuming. So quite a lot of the time in the stuff I've done, for example, for Audible, the Alien sagas, we've actually recorded static actors, and then I've done all the movements and all the sound effects, the foley, the movement sounds of the actors
Oh, in production.
In post-production, so that we can move more quickly through it. And also I can record them very, very clearly on very clean shotgun mics, the sort of mics they use on film sets, because I'm always aware that we have to be up there technically with what's in the movies. So there are two ways of, there's more than one way to skin a cat, as the saying goes. And I tend to, I'm happy to work either way. I love working with actors physically because we get a lot more done. And if I'm doing something like Neverwhere, Neil's Neverwhere with James McAvoy, James is a very physical actor, and James will come up with ideas. Well, you know, can I lay down for this one? Because he's supposed to be laying down. And I say, yeah, you know, lie down, mate, do it. And then he comes up with this great kind of business where he's getting up off the mic and he's going down again.
Oh, so he's actually acting it out as he's doing the voice acting. Oh, wow.
Physically, it's happening. And that reads really, really well. There's a scene in the first episode where he meets Dor, who's played by Natalie Dormer, and he sleeps on the sofa in the living room, and she sleeps in his bed when he rescues her, and she comes out and finds him. We have a little scene where she finds him, and James played it lying down, sitting up, and you know, and so on. And it all reads. It all comes across if you're listening, you know, through a pair of headphones or through earbuds or whatever. And this is the magic of this medium, is that you're actually in the room with them. It's more immersive than, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong. I sit down and vegetate in front of the TV like anyone else. You know, I'm happy to have a story told to me. But at the end of the day, you're a passive spectator, whereas listening to the audio, you're actually kind of in the room. You don't have to do anything, but you're there. It's happening around you, even if it's only in stereo.
Well,
In fact,
you're also providing the images that TV would provide for you, but here you have to provide them based on the sounds you're hearing.
well, yeah, and that, you know, obviously, you know, it's great to see someone being, you know, a much loved character on TV and so on. But on the other hand, some of the things I've done, like the comic book stuff, people have very clear ideas of how they see that stuff. And when it's shown on TV, they're rather upset because it's not the way they saw them in their mind's eye. Well, we can tell the story just as dynamically and visually, but you put the faces on the characters, you put the clothes on them, you make the settings, you interpret them into the way that you've done. And I'm sure, you know, like our Batman Nightfall, you know, for every listener, there was a different version of Batman and a different version of Gotham City. You know, Batman in one of the, you know, from one of the many eras of Batman, Gotham City in one of the many eras of Gotham City. So that's kind of one of the beauties of what we do. It's very flexible. And you can even get your ironing done while you're enmeshed in Gotham City.
Well, a lot of people listen to podcasts like that now while they're doing
Yeah, I
something
do.
else with
I
their
get the
earbuds.
ironing done. I listen back. I check listen to stuff. I get the ironing done. My wife loves
Now,
that.
I have my nerdy question here. We talked about setting the scene like with Metropolis and Gotham City with the sound of the city sirens, car noises, traffic, birds chirping in the case of Metropolis, but also the sound of the voices you've mentioned in previous interviews are important as well. I want to take an example. I just listened to your Good Omens, which you adapted from Neil Gaiman and Terry Pratchett's book. In the first episode, the main characters is the angel Aziraphale and the demon Crowley, which is perfect for this show. They're talking in a bookstore, and then one of them suggests they step outside for some fresh air. They go to feed the ducks, take a walk. Besides the sound of the ducks quacking and splashing in the background, how do you evoke through the voices alone the difference between them talking in the bookstore and talking outside by the duck pond?
Okay, well, it's, you know, speaking entirely technically, all of it was done inside a studio. Well, we could have gone on location for the duck bit. Basically, inside the shop, we built an acoustic in the studio. We put some screens with the hard sides facing inwards so the voices would bounce off them around the actors, Peter Serafinowicz and Mark Heap. Like those walls, you know, because, you know, in a room, I'm sure you can hear I'm in my office. So probably, you know, my voice is bouncing off these walls a bit because I haven't treated this as a studio. I'm just speaking into a little SM58 to you now. And you know, I'd add a bit of muffled street noise outside, and the odd customer might come in the shop, and then you'd hear the door open, the shop bell go, and the street noise become louder, and as they go out again, the shop, you know,
ways of establishing your indoors, you know, that you can hear the room around the characters. You might hear the floorboards are a bit creaky. I might add a bit of floor noise. I like to hear characters moving a tiny bit while they're talking. So all of this sort of feeling of being in a space, existing physically, would be going on. And then they walk out through the door. Let's say we just walk out in the street, so I can make it a very immediate cut, so I can make it clear what I'm doing here. So we hear the door open, and this time, instead of the door closes and they're still in the shop, they're out in the street, they're out in Soho. Now, immediately what I do is I move them from the microphone I've set up to be an interior to exterior microphones. And on Good Omens, I know for a fact I had them on shotgun mics. I moved them to another part of the room, screened off with soft sides in to absorb all sound. And the shotgun mics, Sennheiser 416s, if anyone's interested. Very good shotgun mic. Put Mark and Peter on opposite shotgun mics so they could work eye to eye contact. Always get your actors with eye contact if you possibly can, because it improves their timing no end and they like it better. I've got a very dead acoustic now. What I then do is I take off a lot of the bottom frequencies on the voices, and because if you are outside, you'll notice that low frequencies tend to disappear, and so you'll lose the voices and suddenly it'll sound a lot thinner. Then you add a little bit of air, just air, you know, there is literally the sound of air, the sound of the open air, and a little bit of traffic going by and so on and so forth. And then maybe, I mean, for when they're in the park feeding the ducks, I wouldn't do this because there's enough open space. But if I was in a street, I might add a little bit of slap echo as the voices come back off the building opposite. But generally, it's kind of just how you perceive someone's voice to be in a location very much comes down to the reflection, the quality of the voice in terms of its tonal, the frequencies, tonal frequencies you can hear, and any reflections coming off of buildings or walls or so on. So indoors, much more reflective, more bottom end, more bass on the voices. Outdoors, thinner voices, less reflections, a little bit of air. Add the old duck.
That's why I think it works so well. I mean, your attention to detail here is just incredible.
Yeah, that goes back to me saying, you know, went to at the AM, I suddenly realized what a rod I'd made for my own back by going so thoroughly into this. But the thing is, once you start doing it, you can't go back. You have to do it.
I wanted to get to a podcast. So you started, of course, with the BBC. You still do some work with them, but you also work on audiobooks with Audible, including the Alien series. And I know there was a time when you were saying you were doing some animation and some video games because the audio dramas weren't really coming through the BBC. And then all of a sudden you had Audible, you had the internet, and that kind of turned things around. Do you see a kind of a revival now of radio theater? Of course, we had radio as the primary medium in the 30s and 40s. You had that golden age. But there's so many fiction podcasts now, and they just seem to be getting better and better. Of course, there's so many that, you know, some aren't quite that good. But I wonder what you think of that. And also, Dirk, if there's any ones in particular that you follow that you appreciate.
I think it's interesting because, you know, 15 years ago, I was kind of thinking I'd have to start finding another line of work. And it wouldn't have been the first time that my playing the drums had paid the grocery bills, you know, in our household, because things were really, really, really tough. And yet things happened. Douglas Adams asked me if I'd finished The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which was, just a wonderful thing to happen. And it's funny, you know, things that happened to you early on. There was an actress called Diana Dawes, kind of the British Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, yes, I've heard of her.
She had a great quote. She said, be nice to the people you meet on the way up. You'll meet them again on the way down. And that is a very, very true thing. And, I had quite a few downs along the way. But the one thing I never lost faith in, you know, the one thing I always tried to bring to the party if I was asked to do something was this very intense, layered, visual way of storytelling. And interesting how quite late in the day, things had got very, very quiet indeed when suddenly I got an email from Heather at the BBC saying, look, I'm going to do Neil Gaiman's Neverwhere, and Neil's asked if you would do the adaptation. And this came off of me 15 years before trying to get BBC Radio to do The Sandman, Neil's epic DC Comics Odyssey. And, you know, Neil had remembered, you know, that we'd actually kind of both been mentored by Douglas Adams to an extent. So we kind of were like strange siblings in a funny way. And, you know, people remember when you've done a favor or you've tried to do right by them. So, you know, that was kind of a good thing. But at that time when we did it, we were interested to see how it would fly, because BBC had been so against doing stuff by an author. The BBC goes through very strange phases. You know, there's a time when I'm making Batman and Superman for them. There's a time when they're telling me that The Sandman is far too populist and, you know, really dumbing down because it's comic books. And I'm beating my head on the desk of the commissioning editor saying, no, you keep your commissioning document says you want to reduce the average listening age of your public from 55 to 35. Believe me, this will do it. And it still doesn't get bored, you know. And so one goes through these trials, and then finally you do it and we make it. And I know this is going to have to be a bit like, you know, the craftsman who makes the watch. You know, when they call it a masterpiece, what they mean is it's the piece of work that proves they are a master of their craft. And I'm sitting in this room doing the post-production on Neverwhere thinking, this has got to rock. This, not just for my own sake, but for Neil's, because Neil trusts me to get this right, and I cannot let this guy down. But the thing was, I wasn't too worried about it. I knew I could do it because I'd had so much practice, but I knew this was the one I had to get right. And when it did go out, when the listening figures went through the roof and the radio network was beside itself with joy at how suddenly, you know, the figures were looking good. Not that they were bad, but, you know, it really was completely out of the blue. That was when I thought, this is interesting, because if it wasn't going to work, if things were really going downhill, this wouldn't have worked, and it did work. And that was the point at which Steve Carsey at Audible in London reached out to me and said, hey, you know, how do you fancy doing something in the Alien universe? And I'm thinking, okay, yeah, why not? You know, I'm always wary because, you know, something you really want to do, you know, you've got to check it isn't going to be kind of the, you know, the funny papers kind of variety of work. And it wasn't. They really meant it needed to be done well, and they listened to what we did. And then doing that, discovering that Audible were taking a leap into the dark. They were trying to bring this back to this is 6-7 years ago now, where the podcasting revolution was happening, but it was more people talking to each other than actually doing dramatized stuff. Not that there wasn't going on, but, you know, something with that sort of profile, that sort of tentpole kind of, you know, summer blockbuster thing, if you like. So it was really an interesting progression to suddenly all the doors that had been slammed, locked, welded shut for so long were just swinging open effortlessly. And it was because people who hadn't before listened to stuff realized that they could listen to stuff, and it was like having a movie in their head. And this became so interesting to me. And so when, you know, we did The Alien and it went well and people enjoyed it, and so we made another one, and then would I help my friend Bill DeVries of Pocket Universe Productions work on X-Files with Gillian and David for Audible. Again, you know, it's kind of like, oh, this is interesting. You know, if Gillian and David are signing up to this, you know, people are taking this seriously. And then Mitch Pileggi comes aboard, and then we get Bill Thingamy, the cigarette smoking man, and all this. And you get this, you begin to realize, oh, this is interesting. This is taking off. And then we're going to San Diego, and I'm doing a panel with David.
Oh, you were at Comic-Con there.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's not, I'm not sitting there thinking, oh, I'm so cool now I've made it to San Diego. I'm just thinking, thank God, all that preparation was actually worth, that was actually worth doing. That was actually a worthwhile exercise. We're getting somewhere. And that was the moment when I thought, yeah, you know what? I think this has got a future, because if America is rediscovering this, that's good news, because Britain hadn't really lost it. If anything, the BBC in Britain is seen as a little bit fuddy-duddy, a little bit fussy and so on. Whereas in America, it's suddenly become new again. It's a fresh, shiny new thing, even though it's been around for years. So this is the thrill now, that it's been rediscovered. And, you know, the fact that I don't have to play the drums to pay the grocery bills at the moment is a big plus.
I wanted to ask one last question, Dirk, and this is on a dream project of yours that I read about recently. We mentioned in the intro that you do work with Native American projects in the U.S., such as Native Voices at the Autry Center in L.A., the Native American Public Television in Lincoln, Nebraska. And this dream project of yours, I think, is Dee Brown's book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, adapting that for audio, and maybe with the famous Queen guitarist, Brian May.
Who's he? Sorry, guitarist?
Right.
I really try not to associate with guitarists, being a drummer.
Maybe. Well, he's also a PhD in physics, Dr. Brian May.
Yeah. Oh, him?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's interesting. Brian and I have been talking about this for 20 years now. And we did a sort of fact-finding mission. We spent 3 weeks on holiday. We were just... It was our midlife crisis holiday. We both came to the States, and it was just the two of us going around and into the most unlikely places. And this is a whole sort of story in itself. But basically, we've always been fascinated by Native Americans and the culture and the traditions and the beliefs and what happened and so on. And Dee Brown's book was kind of a springboard, really, because at that time, you know, it was such a revelation, having watched all the cowboy movies, you know, where the Native Americans were always the villainous hordes of, you know, sort of bad guys.
Of course,
and
yes.
Then, of course, you realize that kind of history turned that on its head a little bit. And so we were looking for, we were just looking for the stories, really. So we did all sorts of weird things. We walked around the little Bighorn battlefield. We shot black powder weapons for an afternoon with a bunch of guys dressed as cavalrymen from 1876. You know, I mean, it's truly surreal. But in the end, we did discover a story that hasn't been told, which we were really excited by and we would actually like to do a visual thing with that. And off the back of Bohemian Rhapsody being a success, it looks like that might possibly happen. But I should stress that what we want to do is enable, we would really like the key creatives involved to be Native Americans, because we don't think two middle-class white guys from Britain should be, you know, telling the story. It should be someone else. But if we can make it, if we can help enable it, if we can, you know, make it possible, there's some fascinating stories about culture that a lot of, you know, indigenous American culture that, you know, a lot of everyday life in America, you know, has kind of forgotten. So it's, you know, without in any way judging anyone or in any way trying to, you know, create tensions and divisions, at the same time, there's some history that isn't known about, which is A, fascinating, and B, I think informs how it's very important to be kind to each other and respect each other's differences.
Well, that's all for this episode of Mr. Jones's Neighborhood here on KABU Community Radio, or KABU Neighborhood Radio, as I like to call it. If you missed any part of the show or would just like to hear it all again, You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Mr. Jones's Neighborhood, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big neighborhood thank you to Dirk Maggs, legendary audio theater producer, director, and writer. Dirk's audio adaptation of Neil Gaiman's The Sandman has just been released on Audible. You can listen to all 10 hours and 54 minutes of this glorious production if you're currently an Audible subscriber, and if you're not, you can get a 30-day free trial. Just a note that Mr. Jones's Neighborhood comes to you monthly on every fourth Friday from 11 a.m. to noon. Tune in for our next show on Friday, August 28th at 11 a.m. Hope to see you all again then, if you're wearing a mask and keeping your distance. In the meantime, many thanks to the KBOO staff, Jenna, Celeste, Arthur, Tammy, Asia, Althea, Jenka, Otto, and others, who are keeping the station running while almost everyone else at the station is staying safe and making radio from home. And many thanks to all of you as well for listening. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying may there be better and more beautiful days ahead.